I want to know about the scene on the chapel, because you were way out of your comfort zone, you said. Afraid of heights.
Well, yes, there was a chance of climbing up some steps inside to get up through a little thing, and I didn't really fancy that. So they happened to have a cherry picker on site, so I was lifted up. And I stayed up there for about 3 hours before they came to me. They were doing other things. And there was an assistant director, not Stephen Frears, who was the number three, but the number two, who was called Tim. And we sat and we chatted and discussed things. And finally they came to me, and I said to Tim, I said, I know what they're going to want me to do. I said, is run over the top of the thing and then down the other side. I said, I'm no good at all. I'm the most unathletic person in the world. And hurtled against the thing, and then fire my Sten gun. And of course, I'd never fired a gun. I'd never handled a gun before. And this man came up and gave me the gun and said, right, well, here you are. He said, whatever you do, there's a little hole there. Don't put your finger in that hole. So I said, oh, why not? So he said, well, you'll lose it. So I said, well, might it be possible to have a little piece of cello tape just put over that little hole there? And he said, no, no, no. So I was worried about that. And then, of course, when it came to it, I fired this thing for the first time, and there was this incredible ringing in my ear, and nobody had thought to warn me, or I hadn't thought that it might be loud, and so there was no cotton wool or anything in my ear, and I still have a permanent ring in my right ear, which I've had for the last 50 years, where the top register's gone.
It was such a cavalier attitude by Lindsay Anderson, and the same about the riding of the motorbike on the highway. Just get on a motorbike and ride it.
Yeah, I suppose we were just expected to do things, but the motorbike section was a bit tricky because it was right at the end of filming, and they'd got a film in the can. If we were killed, they'd still got a film. And all Lindsay would say was, go faster, Malcolm, go faster. And Malcolm had learnt to ride a motorbike, he hadn't known before, on a little tiny pop-pop, which they had during the filming, and the stunt arranger showed him it. But this was a huge thing, 800cc. It wasn't taxed, as far as we knew. It was a public road. We didn't have crash helmets. I had my Isadora Duncan scarf on. And it was a bit frightening, but we got through.
No health and safety rules, and you could all have been killed. Anyway, that was certainly impressive. Everybody wants to know always what possessed the headmasters of Cheltenham College and Aldenham School near Radlett to allow Lindsay to make such a film, revealing and ridiculing what went on in the school. And didn't they see the script beforehand?
Well, yeah, a couple of schools had already said no. They didn't want it. And Lindsay rather fancied Cheltenham because he'd been there himself. And in fact, a dummy script was prepared, which was about a quarter or a third of the thickness of the actual script. And I found out about this because on the first day in Cheltenham, I was in the room in the guest house where he put Malcolm and Richard and myself in one guest house, and he put the prefects in another one, the other side of Cheltenham. And we were told that we were not allowed to talk to each other because he wanted an aloofness between us, and he didn't want us to get to know each other. And of course, Malcolm straight away said, well, stuff that. He said, and we went over straight away that night and had a drink with him and didn't dare tell Lindsay. But the nice
script.
Man who had asked me to stay on for the audition was a man called Neville Thompson, who came into my life later on, actually, because I was asked to write the screenplay of Swallows and Amazons, the first one, and that was through Neville, who was by then working with Theatre Projects, Richard Pearlbrow, who wanted to make Swallows and Amazons. So it was all, you know, wheels within wheels. But Neville came into my room and he said, oh, hello, everything all right? He said, have you got your script? And I said, yes, yes, I've been learning lines and everything. So he said, no, not that script, this script, and produced this little thin version. And he said, this is the one that you carry when you're in the school. You never take the real script into the school. And it turned out that this little script had been given to the headmaster, and he had accepted it. And it's a fascinating document because the beating scene, for instance, which in the actual script is described in minute detail, but in that we go into the study, the whip's study, and we're told that we're naughty boys and a disgrace to the school or whatever, and it says, Roundtree suggests a suitable punishment. full stop. And that's it. And none of the baiting scene is mentioned at all.
Well, I'm certainly told that the Aldenham headmaster was not best pleased by this film when he saw the film. And Cheltenham, which is now a co-ed school, of course, mm-hmm. Does not mention at all Lindsay Anderson's name in its roll call of old alumni.
Yeah, how sad.
Distinguished.
How sad.
But I'm parents who were never told about what really went on in schools, a lot of parents were quite shocked, I hear, by finding out.
I think that what went on in public schools was kept within public schools. And I think, and I've met, having written this book and done a few of these screenings up and down the country, I've met some people who very sadly, you know, were undoubtedly scarred by their boarding school life and who never dared tell their parents what was going on.
Scarred by the beatings or by the brutality or by just the natural, the sort of superiority that was inculcated in the
I suppose
senior
I'm,
boys.
Yes, I don't know. I mean,
put
obviously.
Them down.
Yes, the bullying to a certain extent, but just the whole atmosphere, I suppose. I don't know.
But you've heard from a lot of old men.
Oh, well, yes. A gentleman came up to me, and I was signing his book, and I said, did he want his name? And he said, oh, all right. And he said, I'm representing a charity. And the charity was called Boarding Concern. And which I'd never heard of, but I checked it out on the website, and it's a bit like the Samaritans. And apparently many, many people still ring Boarding Concern and are helped because they have been scarred by boarding school experience. People in their 80s and sometimes people in their teens who are actually at boarding school now.
I mentioned the excellent timing of the film, the fact that it was released just as the tanks were rolling into Prague and everything was right about it. When the film was released by Paramount, there were headlines like "Hatchet Job on Public Schools." But in fact, I find, especially seeing it again today, I find that there's an awful lot of fond nostalgia there and reverence, which I think something else that Stephen Frears said that Lindsay Anderson was actually an anarchist, but also a classicist.
Yeah,
read classics, as you know, and he seems to have a sort of real affection for some of the things about his old school.
I think so. All those shots of the exterior of Cheltenham across the playing fields, and there are shots of changing rooms and things littering around, some which are obviously very nostalgic to him. And I think that he did have this nostalgic feeling, and he was, I suppose, doing something more than simply attacking a public school.
Right.
I don't think that was the sole motive at all. I think it was talking about the state of the nation. But it was very interesting how occasionally, but you know the scene where the chaplain, the lovely Geoffrey Chater, he has to tweak Jute's nipple.
Yes, that's
you know?
Great.
And Geoffrey didn't want to do that. He was a very nice man, and he said, no, I don't really fancy doing that. And Lindsay said, you have to do it. It happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were quite a lot of things which were quite personal in there, which he
as with Julian Mitchell, who wrote "Is It Another Country?"
Mm-hmm.
He hated his old school, which was what's that? Tunbridge, and he wrote it with a venom and a real feeling against it. I think we'll open this up to the floor so that everybody here can have a go at asking David about. The filming of If, as I say, it's a lot of the stories in the lovely little book he's written, which you can buy afterwards and he'll sign for you. How's the film for you all seeing it again? Yes, you can.
David, I found it a bit very confusing when the padre was killed in that war scene. Which then he turns up in a drawer.
I think that is a surreal moment, which, in fact, Harold Pinter said to Lindsay that he thought he'd gone a bit far with that shot. And Lindsay may have agreed with that, I don't know. But you see, there's so much in there which is either wishful thinking or, you know, is not real. And with the chaplain, he is shot, You see him collapse. The next shot, he has not been shot because he's saying, please don't shoot. And then he is shot again. And then he's riddling on the floor saying, you know, so one cannot take anything too literally.
No. Same with the scene in the pack horse cafe.
Yes, well, the cafe scene, I mean, I always thought that that was wishful thinking in the sense of, well, both of us to a certain extent, but he, Malcolm and the girl, and the you know, the tiger bit and the rolling on the floor and so on. And by the way, the fact that that scene is in black and white has nothing to do with anything, I mean, except that it looked better in black and white. There are all lots of theories that it goes into fantasy when it's in black and white. That just isn't true. Lindsay was quite
frequently
mischievous.
Asked question.
Oh, yeah.
Is there any significance in colour in black and white, which switches around so arbitrarily?
That's right. The story one has to tell is quite simply that the very first shots were done in the chapel. And this was partly so that Malcolm and I and Richard could just get to know each other without having to do any intimate scenes or anything. We were just sitting there. And after the shooting, we were told to go to Rush's at the Odeon Cheltenham at about 11 o'clock at night. And we had to sit upstairs, and all the big boys were downstairs. And we heard Lindsay saying, let's see. And they played the chapel scenes. And Lindsay said, OK, they were in colour. And Lindsay said, let's see them in black and white. They played them in black and white. And he said, yes, it looks better in black and white print. And what we assumed from that was that the chapel looked better because it couldn't be lit. It would have been too expensive probably to light it so beautifully that it was obvious a chapel. And it looked like a stage set, whereas it looked sort of documentary as and black and white. And from then on, I think what happened was that he got quite mischievous and he said, well, let's do that in black and white because that looks quite good. And he probably was thinking everybody will be talking about this in 50 years' time.
Theorising about it, yes. Analysing.
Sorry, it's a very quick question. The extras in the chapel scene, did they know which film they were in? Did they see the light script or the heavy script?
Well, the extras in the chapel scene were Cheltenham boys. I mean, they were our acting boys, but most of them were Cheltenham boys. No, they wouldn't have seen the script. They would just been told that they were on film for a day and come and sit in the chapel.
Speaking of extras and the scene at the end, in the gunfight, there's an elderly lady screaming bastards while firing the stun gun. I wondered if she was an extra or whether she had some personal connection with somebody on the crew who was settling a family score or something.
Yes, well, I can tell you exactly who she was. Lindsay Anderson, as you know, was very big at the Royal Court. And Anthony Page, the director, was also very big at the Royal Court, and that was his mother. And she'd come down for the day, and Lindsay said, oh, come and be in the scene, and he gave her a line.
He certainly did, yes. Actually, quite a lot of things came from the cast themselves, just suggesting things. That's Malcolm McDowell suggested the naked scene.
Oh, indeed. Well, yeah, I mean, this is a story I tell. Malcolm tells it very differently. Malcolm says that I've got it all wrong. And I say, no, I haven't got it all wrong. But we arrived at the cafe, which is a real transport cafe, and they were serving the real lorry drivers out at the back. And we went in, this was about 7 o'clock in the morning, and we worked out the scene, coming in, going to the counter and all that stuff. And then Lindsay said, right, well, we'll work out the choreography of the fight. And so I was sitting, waiting, rather like I do in the film, but I was just sitting there, and they were doing their bit, and then they were rolling around on the floor. By this time it's about 8 o'clock in the morning, 8:30, and as they came back to the table, Malcolm said, oh God, he'll have us do it naked next. And there was an awful silence. And Lindsay came up and he said, Malcolm, I think you may have just had the most wonderful idea. Would you both do it? And Christine, who was lovely, she came to me and she said, do you think I should do it? And we'd only met that day, and I apparently was the avuncular one who had to give advice. So I said, well, I said, what would your husband say? Because she was married. And she said, oh, I'm not worried about him. So I said, right, well, I think you better ring your agent. And she said, I haven't got an agent. And it was only her second job. She'd played Gigi in Derby Rep, and that was it. And so I said, well, I can't really advise, but she agreed to do it. And that's how it got in. Now, that is my story. It may have been that this was all prefabricated. It may have been that Lindsay had said to say that, Malcolm, and then we'll do it that way. I don't know. But it was interesting because it was not in the original script. The nude scene was not in the original script.
And you think it's a teenage fantasy anyway? Mm. I mean, well, it comes across as a teenage fantasy. Mm. Okay. Hard to know. Yeah. There's this question up there.
One scene which I always enjoy for the 20th, 30th time is when you and Mika start giggling about the nail's speed and the speed of the nail. I think you said that Lindsay Anderson kind of worked you towards that with a drink, is that right?
Well, yes, that's true. There was this scene coming up the next day that we had to do, which is all about the most horrible way to die. And Malcolm and I particularly said, we don't understand this scene, what's going on? And Malcolm said, oh, well, we'll go and tell Lindsay. So we did, and Lindsay said, he said, a very badly written scene, it's terrible. He said, don't worry, come in a bit early tomorrow and we'll work around it, we'll improvise, we'll do something and it'll be all right, don't worry about it. So we went off, came back the next morning and did exactly that. Before the crew arrived, we just improvised. And finally we got to a stage where we thought we were ready, by which time the crew had arrived and they had a quick look and they did a quick light. And Lindsay shouted, Stuart, and Stuart Baird, who became quite famous as a director and a very good editor, he was then the runner, he came up and said, Stuart, you know, go and mm-mm, and Stuart came back with this bottle of whiskey. And Lindsay forced the three of us to have a swig of whiskey, and then another swig, and by which time we were quite giggly. And they got ready and they said, turn over, and we did the scene and we were laughing too much, too soon. So Lindsay then shouted, saying, stop it, you're meant to be professionals, what are you doing? And he said, oh, you're just giving us a little. But we did it, and we did it quite quickly. And it wasn't until I saw the film for the very first time, which was months later, that I realised that we had done it word for word, exactly as written. And so what he'd done was to very cleverly allowed us supposedly the freedom to improvise, but had brought us back to the original text, and I always thought that was rather clever.
It's a brilliant scene, actually, because it's like many of the scenes in that film, which just show what boys are like, got boys together, and how they fill in their time, or did in the olden days, in your day, fill in their time at school. A lot of utter foolishness and puppyish behaviour. Are there any more questions? Oh, yes. Yeah. Sorry.
Oh, sorry, there's one more here at the back.
Thank you.
David, was there any reason that the Missa Luba was chosen as a repeat theme?
Well, the story that is always told, which I have no reason to disbelieve, is that that was Malcolm's idea. And I don't know quite why. I don't know how he'd come across it. But that's what we've always been. That's what Malcolm's always said. But he could be lying. I don't know. He used to tell the most amazing porkies to people and wind people up in the most appalling way. We once had dinner with a man who was an airline pilot, and Malcolm was saying in utter seriousness, "Well, I could drive one of those. I could do that." And this man who'd had a few drinks, he was saying, "But you can't. You're taking him very, very seriously. No, he's wicked."
I've got a question at the back, I think.
Which interiors were down to Jocelyn Herbert?
That's an interesting question, but I think she had overall design control. Mm-hmm. The study scenes were not real. I mean, they were done in a studio at Merton Park Studios, so she probably designed those as you would for a stage set. The dormitories were at Aldenham. And Lindsay said that they were so awful in their decor that he had to ask the school if the film company could redecorate them. Because otherwise people wouldn't believe it. He said people would say, I'm exaggerating. So they repainted them, but the school insisted that they were repainted back to the original sludge green or whatever afterwards, and that was done. But things like the gym, that was real, and that was Aldenham. So I think Jocelyn probably would have had something to do with the headmaster's study, for instance. I mean, now that was interesting because that was in Knightsbridge. That was in a big house in Knightsbridge and on the second floor. And it was the only time we ever sort of ventured out. It was quite exciting, really, because we were allowed out at lunchtime. And, you know, we became a bit like schoolboys. And in our school uniforms, we all went to Harrods and we went to weigh in. Up, do you remember weigh in up on the top floor? And Malcolm was wicked then. He was going around as though he was trying to pinch things and wanting to try things on. So we had a lovely day then, an away day. But she would have probably designed that.
It's extraordinary. You're both 24, you and Malcolm, behaving like schoolboys, behaving like real schoolboys.
Well, yeah, it's not quite, not really. And I suppose I was led a bit because I always had this thing of stepping back a bit and being able to see through him. And he knew that I could see through him. And there was this little look that he used to give me sometimes when he was winding somebody up. And I'd sort of say, off you go again. And I was very fond of him because he was terribly, terribly good. And yet,
yes,
when we did that scene, the very first scene where he's shaving his moustache off and so on, that was the first sort of intimate scene we did. And I have to say, I was during it and after it, I was thinking, you know, what's all the fuss about, really? I didn't know, couldn't say. But the moment you saw the rushes and you saw him up on that screen, my word, he had it.
He did, yes. Are there any more questions?
Yes.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Firstly, thank you for such a terrific part in a terrific film. It was my talisman all through school, and I'm sure a lot of other people my age feel the same. I know a lot of people who wish they were here today.
How old are you?
22.
Gosh. Wow.
But it's quite similar now. it's the same atmosphere. Though I wasn't at that one. But anyway, I just wanted to know, it's a bit of a vague question, but watching yourself when you're so young, watching it now, do you have any insights or views on that? Because it seems, I can't imagine it, and it seems like an incredibly strange thing to do. Does it feel like somebody else? I have some other questions, but I will stop talking. Thank you.
No, yes, people often ask that, and the fact is, to a certain extent, I've never liked watching myself in things when I did other things. But what happens is when I watch, I'm not really following the film as such. I'm remembering things that were happening on that day. I mean, there are a couple of the scene, the History Master scene, which the wonderful Graham Crowden, who I kept in touch with and I met up until he died in his 90, wonderful, wonderful man. And terribly, terribly funny. Well, now, that scene, what I think about is my hair, because it's been cut in a most peculiar way. And what happened was that Betty, who was the hairdresser on the film, called me in after lunch one day, and it was quite obvious she was pissed. And she nearly cut my earlobe off. And I said, Betty, you know, are we sure? Oh, yes, it'll be all right. And she cut, and I got a sort of funny fringe, which I hadn't had before. And there are certain shots where you can see this, and I hate that, because I don't look as good as I thought I looked in the other bits. But that's what I'm thinking about, nothing else. But also, it is true, one is thinking, can it really have been 50 years ago? And an awful lot has happened since then, and a lot of hair has fallen out, and...
No, David, you're just right, in absolutely right. In
I haven't changed at all, have
but,
I? No,
and I think you make the point in the book that when during filming, when you found that you just wanted him to say, good, that was good, or well done, or something encouraging like that at the end of shooting a scene, and he said, you're looking very glum-faced, what's the matter? And you said, we didn't know how you feel. And he said, crossly...
That's right. I mean, he got very angry, because the truth was, he used to walk away after the end of a shot and say, right, on! And you never knew, and I said, well, I just don't know whether I'm doing what you want. And he said, you wander around looking miserable. And so he suddenly got very angry, and he looked me straight in the face, and he said, I took 6 months casting this film. And he walked away.
There you are. That is the voice of authority. Genius.
It was a wonderful thing of liberating feelings, because he was saying, you know, are you saying that I got this wrong? Are you doubting my ability to cast? Yes, you are doing what I want, and I will tell you if it's not. And so from then on, I was really rather happy the whole time. It was nice.
Well, there was he, a craggy-faced, authoritative-looking... impressive old boy of Cheltenham College with a natural superiority about him and knew what he wanted. Hello, I can see. I can see. And then what? Yes, but this is the last question. Okay. Yes, approximately.
One's heart went out to the very young new pupil at the beginning. Did he make a career as an actor? I've never caught his name.
Yes.
What happened to him afterwards?
Sean Berry, his name, B-U-R-Y. Yes, he did carry on acting, and he made two or three films. I talk about that in the book, and I'm waffling a bit because I can't remember the names of the films. But he did give up, and he started working with disadvantaged young people and so on, and saying that this was extremely rewarding. And I found a website. He went to, I think, Brighton, a school in Brighton. I don't know whether it was Brighton College. And I found him there as an old boy, and it mentioned this, the fact that he changed careers and felt that he was doing the right thing.
He was so sweet.
Yeah. Oh,
very touching.
Again, brilliant casting.
Brilliant
casting. You see, quite a lot of us were actors. We were so-called professional actors, but an awful lot were not. I mean, Peanuts, isn't he wonderful with the telescope? I mean, he was extraordinary. Philip Bagenal, he didn't go on to act, but he created a recording studio, which became one of the most important and successful recording studios in London, with all sorts of famous bands and sort of recording there. It's interesting when you find out what some of them got up to afterwards.
Well, I remember when I first saw it in 1968, I felt rather let down and cross about the ending, because I thought it was perfunctory, and I thought, what happened next? Which was a daft question, I now see. I'm used now to seeing at the end of a film exactly what happened to every single member of the cast, a member of the film, and to see what they are doing now. In fact, Lindsay Anderson said that, very helpfully, that it's clear, the ending is clear, Mick cannot win, because the world rallies, as it always will, and brings its overwhelming firepower to bear on a man who says no. He's the rebel. The rebel will not win. That was his view. And in fact, you were going to do a sequel.
Yeah. Well, yeah. About 20 years ago, I suppose, maybe even more, Malcolm rang me up from America and said, we're all going to work again. If two is coming on. And David Sherman was writing with Lindsay, and apparently there was a script. I have never seen it, and I've never heard that it's anywhere. It may be in the Lindsay Anderson archive. And I don't know much about it, except that I had become a clergyman.
Yes, there you are. Yeah. Mick had become a Hollywood film star.
Yes, you see.
And Wallace, a one-armed major.
That's right.
And you a clergyman.
Yeah, and apparently at one point we crucify Roundtree. I don't know quite how.
Are there any more questions at all? Because I think it's time we've got to wrap up, because another film is going to start. Is that right? Okay, thank you very much, everybody, for coming.
Thank you. I'll be upstairs.
Yes, thank you.